Hello, and welcome back to AASA, the School Superintendent Association's Public Education Policy Podcast, or PEP Talk for short. I am Kat Sturdivant, the AASA Advocacy and Governance Coordinator, and your host for each episode. This month is particularly important to us at AASA. We are dedicating the April episode of PEP Talk to the ongoing fight to keep public dollars with public schools and focus on the saga of school vouchers. What are they? How are proponents of the program justifying the transfer of these public funds into private institutions, and the litigation taking place in states to fight back? Without further ado, let's get to the episode. I'm here with Jessica Levin, Litigation Director at the Education Law Center. How are you, Jessica?
Great. Thanks so much for inviting me to the podcast, Kat.
Yeah, of course. So this topic, I'm very excited to talk about. It's something that we talk about a lot at AASA. So to set some levels, let's talk about the Education Law Center and the Public Funds Public Schools campaign.
Well, Education Law Center pursues justice and equity for public school students by enforcing their right to a high-quality education in safe, equitable, non-discriminatory, integrated, and well-funding learning environments. And Education Law Center has been doing that for now 50 years. Public Funds Public Schools is a national campaign directed by Education Law Center, and I direct the PFPS campaign. And what we do is seek to ensure that public funds for education are used to support and strengthen our public schools, rather than by being diverted to private education, such as through vouchers. Both Education Law Center and Public Funds Public Schools use a variety of tools and strategies to accomplish this work. We use litigation, policy advocacy, research, and communication strategies. And we do a tremendous amount of work with partners across the country, including AASA and many state affiliates. And it's always a pleasure to work with you all.
The same can be said from our side. It is to have the Education Law Center focused on the work that they do is just such a boon for us. Let's launch into it. Last year, there was a tidal wave of school voucher laws being enacted across the country. And we know you closely track legislation that is moving in states. Can you tell us what is happening with school voucher bills passing this session and what states could have new or expanding programs this year?
Yes, tracking legislation is an important part of our work. So for about 5 years now, the PFPS campaign has been tracking all voucher bills in state legislatures and the U.S. Congress. And we make much of that information publicly available on the PFPS website on our bill tracker. So you can use that tool to search by bill, by state, and or by year. And you can search your state or for examples of specific types of bills across the country. There's a short explainer video to walk you through how to use the tool on the website. And we also have a number of tags that we've developed to tell you which type of voucher a bill is talking about, the eligibility criteria for the program, whether it's a new program or an expansion, et cetera, et cetera. So you can use all those tags to either search, or when you find a bill, you can look at those tags. And those are things that we have done to categorize these bills and let people know what they're about. Also, when a bill passes one chamber of a legislature, we write our own PFPS summary of the bill and post it on the tracker. We continue to see this year, of course, many, many voucher bills, as in all the recent years. And we continue to track them and to try to have a national view of this is helpful so that we can try to get ahead of trends and see what's going on and then support people in individual states who are fighting these bills, but with that national perspective. So what are we seeing this year? We continue to see a lot of education savings account style vouchers and tax credit style vouchers. They also continue to have a wide range of names that try to obscure the fact that they are vouchers. But of course, it's very important that public school advocates call them all what they are. Call them vouchers. Another continuing trend is universal or near universal voucher proposals. So vouchers that are open to any family, regardless of income, even the wealthiest families, and regardless of whether they have ever been enrolled, whether these children have ever been enrolled in public school before, or their family is already paying for private school. Last year, starting in 2022 with Arizona, but then in 2023, more than half a dozen states passed universal vouchers. And we're seeing many universal voucher bills again this year, for example, in Tennessee. We also continued to see vouchers funded from general revenue. In earlier years, many vouchers were funded by diverting money directly from public school appropriations, but now there's a trend toward funding vouchers from general state revenue, if not from tax credit schemes. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on in our interview because it's very important to know how to talk about those funding schemes, and why they're still so harmful for students and schools and communities. I just want to note that there's also a push to put forward ballot measures that would institute voucher programs. So a different mechanism than passing them through directly through the legislature. And there's also a push, for example, in Kentucky to advance constitutional amendments that would clear the way for voucher legislation. So there's a lot of different things going on in the legislative and policymaking space. In terms of, specific states and what's going on, there are some significant voucher bills that have passed this year. For example, in Alabama, a large-scale tax credit voucher bill, and I'll talk more about that specific type of bill. Recently, a new voucher bill passed in Georgia, despite the amazing efforts of advocates there. There are some wins for public school advocates already this year. For example, in Idaho, was facing again large-scale voucher bills that have died in committee, and dozens of voucher bills die in states across the country every year. That doesn't get as much press, but it's really important to keep in mind.
We'll have a link to the tracker in the show notes as well, so our members can check that out and take a look at what is going on in your state. What types of legislative voucher proposals are you seeing this year compared to in years past? Are there new trends? Is it looking different? Is it the same thing, just colored differently?
Great question. There's much of the same, and then there are new trends, and the existence of new trends is a continuing story. And that's because voucher proponents need to change the names, they need to change the mechanism in order to try to evade getting labeled as a voucher because they know the public doesn't like vouchers, in order to try to evade legal challenges and political criticisms. But again, these are all vouchers, and they're all, one is just as bad as the next, if not worse. We are continuing to not see as many of the conventional type of just tuition voucher directly from the state, but we are, as I said, continuing to see many education savings account style vouchers and tax credit style vouchers. Something that's new this year or starting last year that I really want to make sure that people know about and your listeners know about is what I'll call large-scale refundable tax credit vouchers. For many years, many, many years, states have had programs providing individual tax benefits to families for their own private education expenses. This is different from tax credit scholarship vouchers, where people donate, quote unquote, donate, contribute to a voucher, a third party voucher granting organization, and then that third party hands out the vouchers. This is different. This is getting an individual tax benefit, a deduction or a credit for your own children's private education expenses. And that's been around for a long time and it's problematic. But until recently, these individual tax credits had been capped at relatively low amounts. We're talking $500, $1,000. Last year, Oklahoma enacted one that was much larger and had universal eligibility. And we have now seen these similar proposals in several states this year, and one has passed in Alabama, for example, and we've seen proposals in several states. Even though they're different from tax credit scholarship vouchers or the other types of vouchers, they're all the same in that proponents will argue that they don't impact public funds because they're a tax credit, and I'm going to talk about why that's not true. But that is, I think, the biggest and most significant new trend. It's flying more under the radar because it's part of the tax code. It's harder to understand. It's even more muddled, and it's very, very dangerous.
What are some of the tried and true messages of voucher proponents that are hardest for public education advocates to combat? And what are your suggestions for responding to them? We see a lot of it on Twitter, a lot of it on social media. So, what are your recommendations?
Well, I want to touch briefly on the idea of choice because, of course, privatizers call these school choice programs. And you may have heard by now, a common way to push back against that is to remind everyone that this isn't choice for families, this is choice for private schools, because in the vast majority of voucher programs, private schools are allowed to discriminate on a wide range of bases that public schools would never be allowed to, are not allowed to, and people would never accept public schools being allowed to do so. So we should not accept publicly funded private schools being allowed to discriminate on those bases, pointing out all the ways that students and families can get discriminated against by private schools, and that we shouldn't be publicly funding that is something that it won't convince everyone, but it should be convincing, and it will convince some people that vouchers are not a good idea. And so flipping around that choice language and that choice argument. I also want to talk somewhat in depth about the arguments that pro-voucher groups make, that vouchers don't cost a lot, that they even save the state money, that money just follows the child. These are things that we've all heard by now, and they are simply not true, but responding to them can get a little bit tricky. So I want to walk through some responses and some tools for listeners to use when responding to this pro-voucher argument that vouchers are fiscally responsible and a great fiscal choice for the state. So, first of all, vouchers are very expensive. That's the first response. It's no longer possible to say these are just tiny programs that don't cost a lot. That's simply untrue now. They're costing hundreds of millions and billions of dollars annually. So, as voucher programs have become more expansive, and as we just talked about in several states, universal, the fiscal impacts have taken on a lot more urgency. Research lays out this simple truth about voucher costs. For example, a 2021 policy brief estimated that universal vouchers could increase the total public cost of education by 11 to 33%, or $66 to $203 billion per year. So that's the type of additional cost we're looking at if vouchers were to spread across the country. Another argument that can be particularly persuasive, even with those who are fiscally conservative, is that vouchers entail a lot of fraud and waste, and that drives costs even higher. So there are lots of examples from lots of different states, from Arizona to everywhere else, about overpayments to private schools, overspending by voucher-granting organizations or organizations that administer vouchers, fraudulent spending or very questionable spending, especially in ESA programs. So lots of examples there. Related to this, you will hear voucher proponents argue that vouchers actually save the state money, because the money just follows the child to away from the public school to the private school. Nothing is lost. That might seem true at the very surface level, but it's only true at that if you don't get into it at all beyond that surface level. So Public Funds Public Schools has a fact sheet on our website called The Myth of Cost Savings from Private School Vouchers that lays out half a dozen really concrete evidence-backed reasons that vouchers do not, in fact, save money. Here's a few of them. Vouchers shift education expenses to parents because voucher amounts are too small to cover all their expenses, not just tuition, which is often higher than the voucher, but let alone other expenses like transportation, food, special education services that are all free in public schools. So vouchers don't save money, they just shift the cost onto the backs of parents and families. Voucher programs also don't change fixed costs in public schools. So when schools have less enrollment and less money, but the same financial obligations for fixed costs like facilities, pensions, transportation, libraries, when you take a few kids out of each classroom, you still need all of those things and all of that infrastructure. But when you have less enrollment, you have less money. Voucher programs also concentrate higher need and higher cost students, like students with disabilities, in public schools. And that goes back to the discrimination because many private schools will not take higher need students. And so you have a higher concentration of higher need students, but less money in public schools. And the final one I'll mention is that vouchers subsidize private education for students who would not otherwise have attended public school. So that's really important to combat this money follows the child example. Children who are already in private school are not currently being paid for by the government. Their education isn't being covered by public funds. But when you make especially a universal voucher program that doesn't have a prior public school enrollment requirement, you are simply adding thousands of children to the rolls of who's getting their education paid for by the government. And so you're adding a lot of cost. On that last point, we have a lot of emerging data that large percentages, sometimes the vast majority of vouchers, will be used by people whose children are already in private schools. So, meaning it's not just the same money moved to another spot, the state is now paying for additional children. Another major truth about voucher spending and that we're working to make more widely known is that it increases over time. So starting small is no protection against eventually having an enormous voucher bill that can break state budgets and public education budgets. Your readers are probably, or your listeners are probably aware of the tactic of starting with a limited voucher program, get a foot in the door, and then it just expands over time. So in 2023, Public Funds Public Schools published a report by Doctors Samuel Abrams and Stephen Koutsavlos at Teachers College, Columbia University, called The Fiscal Consequences of Private School Vouchers. And it examines the growth in voucher programs and spending in seven states in the decade following the Great Recession. And the findings include that in each of the seven states, expenditures of public funds on voucher programs increased dramatically during those 10 years. For example, growth in Georgia reached 883%. Also, nearly all the states examined were diverting hundreds of millions of dollars to voucher programs annually by the end of the period studied. And of course, many of the states we now know are diverting a billion or more: Ohio, Arizona, Florida, with multiple billions of dollars annually. And at the same time, that study documented that funding, at the same time that funding for vouchers was climbing significantly in those seven states, the portion of state GDP allocated to K-12 public education decreased, even though public school enrollment was increasing in most of those states over that time. So voucher programs increase and increase in cost. The final point I want to make here is that you can't trust a lot of the cost estimates from legislatures and pro-voucher groups. The cost of voucher programs frequently outpaces those initial estimates. So to take just one example, New Hampshire's ESA voucher was projected to cost the state about $130,000. But by 2023, spending on the program was nearly $15 million. And an independent analysis released by Reaching Higher New Hampshire projects that that program, which has been expanded, could cost $48 million per year. And they may even have a new estimate at this time. So I want to talk a little bit about contrasting with this with public school underfunding, but those are hopefully some tools and arguments to push back against the lie that vouchers save money.
That's exactly what we're trying to communicate to our members through doing this episode and making a lot of this work more visible. So we touched on this a little bit. My next question is about how proponents of school vouchers justify the transfer of public funds away from traditional public schools. We hear like public schools aren't working or anything like that. And in addition to that, what are policymakers also saying to justify the implementation?
There's a few things that they say. I'll give you a couple of examples. First, they try to claim that funding isn't actually being transferred away from public schools. They will say that vouchers don't cost the state more, that they save money. So we just discussed answers to that. They will also say that some vouchers, like tax credit vouchers, aren't even funded with public dollars. And that's not true. So it's really important to understand how to push back against that. So with tax credit vouchers, individuals and corporations give money to voucher granting organizations. They're often called something like a scholarship granting organization, an SGO. And those third-party SGOs then hand out vouchers for private school tuition. Then the taxpayer gets back some or all of the funds that they contributed in the form of a credit against their tax liability, not a deduction, but a credit. And sometimes it's 100% credit or something close to that. So money that would have gone into the state treasury as taxes that people owe in taxes and then would have gone to support public institutions and public goods and like public schools, which are a large part of state budgets, that money instead goes to the third party organization and then to a voucher. So this is absolutely a diversion of public funds, money that would otherwise be in the state treasury, and we can't let pro-voucher groups tell us otherwise. That's a major argument that pro-voucher groups and the policymakers will advance to try to tell us that vouchers don't take money away from the public treasury and away from public schools, but of course they do. And then also, no matter how vouchers are funded, they will reduce enrollment of public schools. And because state funding formulas, public school funding formulas are tied at least partly to enrollment, that drop in enrollment in public schools will lead to a drop of funding for public schools while, as we talked about a little earlier, while they still have the same fixed costs, while they have a higher concentration of high need students, et cetera. Bottom line is funding a voucher program through a tax credit instead of a direct appropriation or any other way doesn't make it any less a voucher, and we need to keep calling it a voucher. Another bucket of arguments that pro-voucher groups and policymakers will advance is they'll justify taking money away from public schools because they'll say that those schools are failing. So first they'll say we're not taking any money away from public schools, and then they might say, well, even if we are, we should be because public schools are failing, and we need to put money somewhere else. There are a few things that we need to be really clear about when they make this argument. First, polls show that people are overwhelmingly happy with their local public school. For example, polls about the COVID-19 pandemic show that people were overwhelmingly happy with how their public school handled things, how they handled the challenging time, and that people are generally happy with their child's neighborhood public school. And that's really different from the narrative that we hear sometimes on a different political plane. The idea of dissatisfaction and the failing schools narrative, that's taking place in a different space than what people are really feeling and saying at the local level with their own kids. Now, that's not to say that our public schools don't have areas where they need to improve or that there are children that they're not serving as well as they could. An education law center fights for public school students' rights to receive the education that they deserve and they're legally entitled to. So we recognize that absolutely. Taking money away from public schools and spinning up a narrative that they are failing broadly is just not true and not the solution to the things that need to improve in public schools. We know what's needed to give every child the opportunity to succeed. And a big part of that is making sure that there's sufficient funding and resources to meet every public school student's needs. So, again, taking funding away just is an attempt to create this self-fulfilling prophecy of school failure that justifies defunding, that leads to worse results, that tries to justify more defunding. So, that's the tactic there. But states are constitutionally obligated under every state's constitution to adequately support their public schools. And it's also just common sense and the right thing to do, of course.
I'm very excited to get into litigation. What about litigation as a strategy to stop voucher proposals works? I know ELCA has led much of the litigation work in states. Do you feel that litigation remains a successful strategy? Is it working?
We do. We hope that voucher laws can be stopped before they pass, or even stopped from being introduced when people raise their voices against them and make known that they don't want vouchers. But a lot of policymakers, unfortunately, are not listening to what the majority of people want, and they are continuing to pass voucher laws. And when those voucher laws pass and they violate a state's constitution, for example, such as the state constitutional protections for public schools and their students, or other constitutional mandates, then they need to be challenged. And one important way to do that is to challenge them in court. So, all the way back in 2016, Education Law Center and others challenged the nation's first universal voucher program. That was in Nevada, sort of a presage of what was to come. And we won. The Nevada Supreme Court struck down that voucher law as violating Nevada's constitution. And then, much more recently, in 2022, there was a lawsuit against Kentucky's tax credit ESA voucher bill, and the Kentucky Supreme Court unanimously struck down that voucher law, and Kentucky remains voucher free. So, yes, litigation is not the only tool to combat vouchers. We need to use many, many tools and give many, many people voices, and use different strategies. But litigation is an important tool, and it also doesn't stand alone when we use it. We partner very closely with state and local groups. Our plaintiffs, who are often public school parents, are the ones challenging the voucher laws in court, and we're very proud to represent them. And then there are robust advocacy and communications efforts around litigation when it happens against vouchers, but it is an important tool.
I love hearing that parents are also being involved in this, that it's so cool that they are realizing what this is doing to their communities and understanding the risks. So what are the main cases to look out for then?
There are several cases pending against voucher programs around the country right now. So there is a challenge in Ohio State Court to Ohio's voucher programs. Very, very important challenge. It has the de state defendants have tried to have the case dismissed and were unsuccessful in the trial court with that request. And so the case is going forward. So very, very important case to watch in Ohio. Then there are two cases in which Education Law Center and Public Funds Public Schools is directly involved. One is in Tennessee. This is a long-running litigation. Tennessee passed an education savings account voucher law back in 2019. It originally applied to two counties in Tennessee, the county where Memphis is and the county where Nashville is. We, along with the Southern Poverty Law Center, the ACLU of Tennessee, and the law firm Robbins Geller, represent a number of public school parents from those counties, as well as community members who all, as you said, see very clearly the danger of vouchers and wanted to challenge this in court. So that case has been going on for several years now, as lawsuits often do, especially education lawsuits. A companion case, a case that made similar claims, went all the way up to the Tennessee Supreme Court, and the voucher program had been enjoined. It had been put on pause, but the Tennessee Supreme Court reversed, and so the voucher program went into effect. Our case is ongoing against the voucher program. It is in the trial court in Nashville, and we are looking forward to vigorously pursuing this challenge on behalf of our clients who are so dedicated to their public schools and protecting them. That's going on in Tennessee. And then in South Carolina, Education Law Center and others represent public school parents, as well as the State Conference of the NAACP in South Carolina and the South Carolina Education Association in challenging the voucher law that passed in South Carolina last year. And we have challenged that law under South Carolina's constitution. We asked the South Carolina Supreme Court to take that case in what's called its original jurisdiction. So, not to have it go through all the lower courts, but this is an important and urgent issue. And because of that, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case immediately. They did so. They heard oral argument last month, and we are awaiting their decision. Those are the three state court voucher cases that I would encourage everybody to watch.
In these cases, in these state courts, what are the main legal arguments presented by those challenging voucher programs and by defenders of the voucher program?
Well, Kat, there are so many ways that vouchers can violate state constitutions, and every state constitution is different. Even though every state constitution has an education clause, a provision guaranteeing public schools for the state's children, those vary in their details, and then the rest of state constitutions vary a lot in their details. But there are some common threads, common themes in state constitutions protecting public schools and protecting against the use of public funds for private education. So I'll give you a few examples. Many states have what are called no-aid clauses that prohibit public funding of private schools. Voucher proponents call these Blaine Amendments, and the reason that they do that is they want to argue that these provisions were spurred by anti-religious or anti-Catholic sentiment. But the reason that these provisions were passed was to protect public school funding. The constitutional framers in all these states knew that public funds are limited. There's a lot of demands on public funds, but they prioritized public education as something that they wanted to make sure limited funds for public education didn't flow away to private schools that wouldn't serve every student, that weren't under the same accountability and quality standards, and on. So, no aid clauses in state constitutions are an important firewall against vouchers. And so, that's one way that vouchers are often challenged. For example, in South Carolina, that's one of the claims. The South Carolina Constitution has a no aid clause, and that's one of the claims that we have asserted on behalf of our clients there that the voucher program violates that part of the Constitution. There are also a lot of different types of claims that are made against vouchers in court under states' education articles, under those provisions that guarantee and protect public education. So, for example, state constitutions mandate public education. There's an implication there that they prohibit funding on private education. Sometimes there are constitutional restrictions right in the Constitution on the use of funds that were raised or gathered for education, for public education, to be used based on private education, that that's not allowed. There are claims and very strong arguments that voucher programs, because they undermine public school funding and resources, that they undermine that core guarantee in the Constitution of an adequate public education for every child. There are also other types of legal arguments outside of education clauses. For example, a lot of constitutions have a requirement that public funds be used for a public purpose. And you can probably imagine how we argue that vouchers are not going to a public purpose. These schools don't serve every student, that they can discriminate, for example, that they don't have quality and accountability standards. And so the public really doesn't know what's going on or whether they're serving any public purpose, really educating students. And often, as we know, voucher program results are worse for students than their educational outcomes in public schools. So, the last thing I want to mention is just claims about the discrimination that takes place in voucher programs or the lack of quality and accountability standards. There are also arguments that are made in court about those. So again, lots and lots of ways that vouchers can violate state constitutions, and we're committed to pointing those out when we need to.
That's fascinating. So, in that case, is there relevant activity in the federal courts?
There is a lot of education litigation in general, and that includes voucher litigation, takes place in state courts because it is in state constitutions that we find those education articles guaranteeing the right to public education, for example. But there's also important litigation to watch in federal court. And I want to just tell you about some cases that have been filed by pro-voucher groups. These are groups that want to, expand vouchers throughout the states, that also are interested in injecting religion into education, into publicly funded education through vouchers, for example. The immediate line of cases here that's relevant, started with a case called the Trinity Lutheran Church versus Comer in the US Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court said was that religious organizations can't be excluded from publicly available benefit programs just based on the fact that they are religious. So the next case that came up in this line of cases, that case was not about vouchers. It was about a preschool, a grant program for playgrounds in a preschool. But the next case in that line was about a voucher program. It's called Espinoza. And it was about a tax credit voucher program in Montana. And the Supreme Court said that Montana's private school voucher program could not exclude religious schools from participation just based on their religious status. So if Montana was going to have a voucher program, it had to include religious schools in that voucher program. It's really important to know that the Supreme Court also said in that case that no state has to have a voucher program. No state is legally obligated to fund private schools. So if states don't want to fund religious schools, they need to not fund any private schools. And of course, we believe that the state should not be funding any private schools for many, many reasons. They should not be funding private school vouchers. The last case in this line from the US Supreme Court is called Carson versus Macon. And it dealt with Maine's town tuitioning program, which is a long-running program that allows towns without their own public schools, because of geography, for example, to either contract with another public school district or specific private school, or let families choose a private school. And the private tuition is paid with public funds. The US Supreme Court, similar to in Espinoza, held that Maine could not exclude religious schools from the program based on their religious status. And it went a little bit further. It said, well, actually, a lot further. It said that these schools couldn't be excluded even if they used the public funds for religious purposes. So, three states have town tuitioning programs: Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire. And after Carson, what we are now seeing currently is various pro-voucher legal groups that are trying to build on that Carson decision from the US Supreme Court by filing several lawsuits in Maine and Vermont, because Maine and Vermont have both made changes to their laws or their policies governing the private schools that participate in the town tuitioning programs to require that they don't discriminate based on religion, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Identity against students, families, and employees. And so, religious schools that want to participate in the program but do discriminate on those bases, or people who want to send their children to those schools with public funds, have filed lawsuits in federal courts. And those are very important lawsuits to watch. And I'm sure that there will be other important lawsuits to watch in the weeks and months to come, including as public school advocates challenge more voucher programs in court.
I'll add in a tidbit that AASA did submit an amicus brief for the Carson v. Mencken case, so we're also paying very good attention to when it enters a federal stage. I'm almost sad to say this is my last question, but any final thoughts to share about voucher trends and how we can best protect and promote public education?
I mentioned this before, but I think it's so important to emphasize that the polls show the public doesn't want vouchers. And another way that we know the public doesn't want vouchers is because every time voters have had the opportunity to weigh in directly at the ballot box about vouchers, they have always said no to vouchers. So it's really important that we continue to educate people about this issue, about the dangers of these programs, because the public understands this. They want to protect their public schools and they understand that vouchers undermine that core goal and that core institution of our democracy, which is our public education system. There are so many people already working for the goal of well-funded, welcoming public schools in every community that are accountable to the community. And this includes teachers and administrators and students and parents and lawyers like me and policymakers and school board members. And Public Funds Public Schools is here to support them. So that's the message I want to end on, that it's an honor to support those who are protecting public funds for public schools in states across the country. It was really a pleasure to speak with you today, Kat. Thank you so much for inviting me to the podcast.
Thank you so much for coming. And that's a wrap on this episode of AASA's Pep Talk podcast. We invite you to share it by using the hashtag Pep Talk on Twitter. You can access past episodes in the Pep Talk library by visiting aasapeptalk.podbean.com. And once again, thank you for joining us.